It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Europe seeks order out of chaos and the tragedy of a migrant crisis. European officials are groping for answers to the flood of hundreds of thousands of both refugees and economic migrants flooding Europe from South Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Hundreds reportedly tried to reach Britain from France via high-speed rail overnight. Hundreds were still being kept out of Hungary's main train station in Budapest in their bid to reach Germany. A Hungarian government spokesman, Zoltán Kovács, says law and order must first be established.
Without discipline, that is, being able to defend, protect the European borders, put the discipline into the flood of illegal migrants and channel them to the official border crossing points, we will not be able to handle their influx. The European Union, including Hungary, should regain its ability to differentiate between refugees proper and economic migrants.
More than 332,000 migrants have arrived this year alone. More are seeking asylum every day. While many Africans are also trying to reach Europe, the International Organization for Migration says most remain on the continent but are moving to countries with better economic prospects. Michelle Bombassi, an IOM regional migrant assistance specialist, says, however, security is more of an issue today in Africa.
Migration is part of the tradition of the culture of the region and plays a major role in the economy within the region. But we also have to mention that in very specific areas, which are, for instance, affected by terrorism or by security threat of different kinds, the presence of large numbers of sometimes of migrants, sometimes undocumented, is a concern for many governments.
Anti-migrant riots broke out earlier this year in South Africa, leaving several dead. This is VOA News. China's President Xi Jinping presided over a massive military parade in Beijing Thursday, marking the end of the Second World War. Japan officially surrendered to Allied forces September 2, 1945. China put on a massive display of equipment and soldiers watched by dozens of world leaders, although many Western heads of state, including President Obama, did not attend. President Xi also announced 300,000 troops would be cut from the People's Liberation Army. He called it a gesture for peace. Chinese and Hong Kong markets were closed for a public holiday today. Other Asian markets gained ground after a week of volatility over China's weakening economy. The benchmark U.S. Dow Jones average Wednesday gained nearly 300 points. European markets posted modest gains. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund's chief, Christine Lagarde, said Wednesday the recent market volatility shows how rapidly concerns can spread from one region to the next. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Wednesday appealed to the American public to support the Iran nuclear agreement.
Iran's nuclear program will remain subject to regular inspections forever. Iran will have to provide access to all of its nuclear facilities forever. Iran will have to respond promptly to requests for access to any suspicious site forever. And if Iran at any time, embarks on nuclear activities that are incompatible with a wholly peaceful program, it will be in violation of the agreement forever.
Mr. Kerry spoke Wednesday in Philadelphia as Congress prepares to vote on the issue later this month. In Nigeria, at least two dozen were killed late Tuesday by armed assailants on horseback in villages in northeast Nigeria. Although there was no immediate claim of responsibility, militants from the Islamist insurgency Boko Haram are suspected. Hundreds have been killed since President Muhammadu Buhari was sworn into office in May, vowing to stamp out the insurgency, which has left thousands dead over a span of 6 years. In Yemen, at least 28 were killed, dozens wounded Wednesday in a suicide car bombing outside a mosque in the capital Sana'a, claimed by the Islamic State militants. The IS group is known to have targeted sites controlled by the Shia Houthi rebels, who are considered heretics. The International Red Cross also says two of its workers were killed in northern Yemen by an unknown attacker. The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo has banned a documentary by a Congolese doctor who has treated thousands of women raped during the country's conflicts. A government spokesman said the film intends to sully and harm the image of the DRC's army, and no country would tolerate that. Dr. Dennis Mukwege founded the Panzi Hospital in Bakavu in South Kivu Province. In 1999, he was awarded the European Parliament's Sakharov Rights Prize last year. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 3rd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia welcomes the UN lifting of sanctions on certain individuals in Liberia.
To the extent that individuals are no longer threats to this nation, they can contribute to the peace and stability of this country. It is not the government policy to push for them to renew on travel ban and for their assets to be frozen.
Augustin Gafuan is Liberia's foreign minister. Sierra Leone will soon deploy an experimental Ebola vaccine after a woman died from the virus. Kenya's teachers' union will not return to the classroom until the government increases their pay. And Uganda's FDC opposition elects a familiar face to challenge President Museveni in next year's presidential election.
Dr. Kizza Besigye, the former president, has won the election with 718 votes to General Muntu's 289. That's about a win of about 70% of the vote.
Alex Atu Hairoi is the news editor of the Ugandan Daily Monitor. South Sudan's president selects four army generals to attend a transitional security workshop in Ethiopia. And the World Health Organization calls for regulation of traditional medicine in Africa. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia says it welcomes the United Nations Security Council decision to terminate sanctions, including a travel ban and asset freeze on certain individuals who had been deemed a danger to the stability of the country. In a resolution adopted Wednesday, the Council urged the Liberian government to take further steps to combat the illicit trafficking of arms and ammunition, prioritizing the timely adoption and implementation of an effective legal framework. Foreign Minister Augustin Gafuan says it has always been the Liberian government's position for the Security Council to periodically review the sanction list. He says Liberia wants all its citizens and partners to contribute to the peace and progress of the nation.
For almost 10 years now, we've had a democracy. I think in 2013, you know that we celebrated 10 consecutive years of peace. And the general government position to the UN has been that the sanction list, travel ban and asset free list should not be kept in stone, that relevant information needs to be evaluated, and to the extent that information will point to the lifting of a sanction or a ban on an individual or individuals, that the UN should do so. So this reflects how far Liberia has come. Liberia wants all its citizens and partners to be contributive of the peace and progress of the nation. We will, as we welcome this resolution, we'll be working with the UN and all our partners to ensure that Liberia's peace and security are not jeopardized going forward. But to the extent that individuals are no longer threats to this nation, they can contribute to the peace and stability of this country. It is not the government policy to push for them to renew on travel ban and for their assets to be frozen.
So the way I understand it is your policy to work for the lifting of all sanctions. Some people who are still under United States sanctions and other countries' sanctions, are you also ready to push for those to be lifted?
We've met members of the U.S. government. In fact, I remember 2 years ago, I met U.S. Assistant Secretary for Africa, Madam Leader Thomas Greenfield at the State Department, and we raised this issue. The U.S. has its own requirements. What we say is that these things need to be regularly reviewed to the extent that individuals are contributive to the peace and progress of the country, that all countries, including the UN, that have taken actions to put them on travel ban and asset freeze, should review it with a view to lifting those. But those countries will have to review based on their data. We, at the level of the government, may not be privy to all the gory details that go into the taking of these actions. But what we say is that it is not helpful to keep these things stuck in history and not reviewed, because people transition in attitudes. So we say that if someone has transitioned in attitude from negative to positive, action should be taken to reflect that transition.
Augustin Gafuan is Liberia's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Over the next couple of days, an experimental Ebola vaccine will be deployed in Sierra Leone's Cambia district after a new case of the virus was detected there on Saturday. The first ring vaccination use of the experimental VSV-EBOV vaccine in Sierra Leone means a World Health Organization and the Ministry of Health team will offer the vaccine to consented contacts of the Ebola virus. WHO spokesperson Dr. Margaret Harris tells Ricky Shryak the rapid deployment of the team and the Sierra Leone government's quick cooperation with Guinea to make the vaccine available has been extraordinary.
It's the first time it's been used in a ring method in Sierra Leone, but it's part of an ongoing trial. And the ring method is the method that's been used in that trial in Guinea. And the important thing is the Sierra Leonean government said, look, we would like to have the opportunity to have anybody exposed to a new case to be offered vaccination as part of the trial as well. It was quite extraordinary how quickly the two countries cooperated together.
Because this is just a vaccine that only in July was deemed something that could possibly work, correct?
It's still only something that could possibly work. What's going on in Sierra Leone is still part of the same experiment. What's really new and interesting here is that one government said to another government and said to us as WHO as well, can we be part of this? We would like, as part of the experiment, to be able to offer this to our people, because the principle of ring vaccination is if you have a case, all the people that are known to have come in contact with the infected person, all those people are offered vaccination, and then also the contacts of those people. So in other words, you put a big buffer zone right around the person who's been infected.
Am I correct? In Guinea, it's a ring vaccination trial. So in that case, in a trial like this, where you're trying to determine the efficacy of a vaccine, do you not have to give some people the actual vaccine and some people a placebo? Now, in both Guinea and Sierra Leone, the vaccine is offered to everyone within that ring right away.
That's right. It's provided right away. Of course, the first thing you have to do, you don't just sort of walk into a village and say, okay, you know, everybody who's been in contact, you know, line up and have a vaccine. The very first thing you do is go and sit with all the people who are affected and say, okay, these are the circumstances. This is what this vaccine is. This is what it does. This is the trial. It is an experimental trial still, and it still follows a certain protocol. And you make sure that people really understand all the elements of the trial and that it is still an experimental trial. And only then, when you're quite satisfied that everybody understands and can give true consent, so they've understood in their own language and they've had long discussions about it, only then do you commence with the vaccination. So that still takes a couple of days. And of course, it takes a day or to identify who all the people who may have come into contact.
And it takes a day or two to get to these places sometimes.
It takes a while, but actually, again, it's extraordinary how quickly the Guinea team got up to in Cambia.
That was Dr. Margaret Harris, spokesperson for the World Health Organization. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Guinea. The chairman of the Kenya National Union of Teachers says the country's teachers will not return to the classrooms until the government increases their pay as ordered by a recent court ruling. Mozo Nzili says President Uhuru Kenyatta's administration has yet to show any commitment or the political will to meet the teachers' demands. A court had ordered the teachers be given a 50 to 60% pay increase, but the government says it cannot afford the increase. Nzili tells reporter Peter Clotty that the union executive leadership decided at a meeting on Wednesday to back the teachers' strike action.
The teachers decided to boycott classes. And so today, the National Executive Council sat and ratified the action by the teachers to continue demanding what was rightfully given by the High Court of Kenya or the Supreme Court.
Now, but Mr. Nzile, the government has come out specifically to say that they don't have the funds to meet the 50 to 60% pay increase awarded to teachers. How do you resolve this impasse?
This government has a lot of money. It only may not have settled on payment because they are not willing. But the moment they begin to take interest in payment, they will do it because they could not have bailed out KQ with over 60 billion unbudgeted. So the argument that the government has no money does not hold water.
How does the leadership of the Kenyan National Union of Teachers plan to negotiate with the government to resolve this impasse? Because the students will be suffering.
The government has a constitution to follow, and the Supreme Court is the highest court in the land. And the learned judges took into consideration the economic situation of the country and the sustainability of the demands. And therefore, we expect the government in its own wisdom to find ways and means of complying with the court order, because the Supreme Court is the highest court, or the apex court in Kenya. We are not going to look for the fund ourselves, but we have every confidence that the government will budge in and try to save the situation and rescue the dwindling education sector in Kenya.
Will the KNUT executives give the government a little bit of room or time in order to come up with some of these funds to pay your workers instead of embarking on the strike by members of your organization?
The Kenya National Union of Teachers started this demand right from January, and the government, when it was doing its budgeting, it knew very well that there was an impending crisis. If by a stroke of the pen they decide that they will pay. You know, we need a commitment. We want some people to come to say, we are committed to pay and we shall pay like this. But we cannot be left in the woods and seek for any negotiations from people who have themselves not initiated the negotiations. And in any case, a court order is not negotiable.
Monzu Nzele is the chairman of the Kenya National Union of Teachers. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Nairobi. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September the 3rd. Let's give a shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Kira FM, in Jinja, Uganda. Daybreak Africa time is 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change, FDC, has elected its former leader, Dr. Kizza Besigye, as the party's candidate to challenge President Yoweri Museveni in the 2016 presidential election. This will be Besigye's fourth time trying to unseat Mr. Museveni, who has been president almost for 30 years. The FDC election took place Wednesday during the party's convention in the capital, Kampala. Dr. Besigye defeated retired army commander and current FDC president, Major General Mugisha Muntu. Alex Atuhaire, news editor of the Uganda Daily Monitor, says Dr. Besigye won the nomination by as much as 70% of the vote. Atuhaire says the challenge now is for the FDC to come out with a strategy so that Dr. Besigye can win more votes during next year's election than he has won in the last three elections.
Dr. Kizza Besigye, the former president, has won the election with 718 votes to General Muntu's 289. That's about a win of about 70% of the vote.
So, Alex, tell me, why did it go the way it went? Why do you think Besigye won by such a landslide?
Dr. Besigye, who has been around in the previous three elections, is still a popular candidate, and would appear that the FDC delegates at the convention were not convinced to hand the baton to a new person. The challenge then remains that can Dr. Besigye attract a little more support than he has been getting to pose a winning challenge to the incumbent, who will clearly be a candidate in the next year's election.
As you said, Alex, Dr. Besigye has challenged President Museveni for three elections. This will be the fourth round. Is there anything different now going into next year's election?
I do not see something very much different. Things would have been different if the opposition had pushed through with the electoral reforms, which hasn't come through. So I think they will be going into the 2016 race more or less of the same old environment. And I don't know what kind of campaign Dr. Besigye will need to run to galvanize the voters. As you know, in the previous election, in the 2011 election, about 40% of the voters did not turn out. 5 million voters stayed away because there was a lot of voter fatigue from the previous two elections. So I think it would be really, really, this year we need to be absolutely creative to attract, one, new voters, also to convince the voters that stayed away from the 2011 elections to come out and vote.
Now, Dr. Besigye defeated the retired Army General Mugisha Muntu. What did General Muntu have to say? Did he say that he is going to support Dr. Besigye's candidacy?
Yeah, a fine gentleman, General Muntu, has just given his concession speech, and he says that he will support Dr. Besigye as the party's flag bearer, and he's accepted the results of the election.
Alex Atuhaire is the news editor of the Uganda Daily Monitor. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. South Sudan President Salva Kiir Wednesday briefed his senior army officers about the peace agreement he signed a week ago. Mr. Kiir outlined to his commanders how the South Sudan government intends to implement the ceasefire, which took effect last week. The president also selected four army officers to attend a workshop this weekend in Addis Ababa on transitional security arrangements and how the ceasefire will work. Philip Ton Aleo reports for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan Army spokesman Colonel Philip Aguer says all of the country's top military officers attended the meeting, which was chaired by Mr. Kiir, who is Commander-in-Chief of South Sudan Armed Forces.
The briefing is about the peace agreement and the implementation, particularly the issues of the ceasefire.
Aguer says military officials agreed at the meeting to implement provisions in the peace deal on security arrangements. The agreement, which was brokered by regional bloc IGAD after months of negotiations, calls for a workshop to be held in Addis Ababa within 14 days of all parties signing the deal. Aguer says four SPLA officers were nominated during last night's meeting to attend the workshop.
They will travel to Addis Ababa and attend a workshop in Addis Ababa on the 4th of this month. Definitely after those workshops, there will be a formation of the joint command that will be stationed here in Juba to oversee the implementation of issues related to the ceasefire.
At the workshop in Addis Ababa, the military officers will meet their counterparts from Chiang Mai Char's SPLM in opposition and IGAD mediators and discuss, among other things, the drawdown of forces in South Sudan, the creation of demilitarized areas, and the cantonment of troops who fought in the 20-month conflict. The officers who attend the workshop will subsequently help to monitor the ceasefire and security arrangements during a 30-month transitional period in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Philip Thona Leo in Juba.
The World Health Organization says the practice of traditional medicine in Africa must be regulated to protect the public against potentially harmful practices. The message comes as the UN body commemorates the 13th African Traditional Medicine Day. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The Mbankomo neighborhood in Yaoundé is home to one of Africa's biggest centers of traditional medicine. 15 healers share a space where they see 30 to 50 patients each day. Among the patients is Herman Hadir, who says he prefers to be treated by traditional means.
I'm very interested in traditional medicine because I've tested some of the medicines and my problem was solved. I use traditional medicine concerning venereal diseases.
Herman is among the estimated 80% of Africans who rely mainly on traditional medicine to treat illnesses and deal with various conditions. Many Africans have no other choice, as hospitals are often far away, expensive, or poorly staffed. But in the wrong hands, traditional medicine can have disastrous consequences. Last Sunday in Yaoundé, a 20-year-old woman died at the home of a traditional healer while having an abortion. Dr. Nick Ngwanyam, a gynecologist at the St. Louis Clinic in northwestern Cameroon, says the traditional sector is now dominated by unqualified practitioners.
We are talking about the proper diagnosis, scientific diagnosis of a problem, and then the management. If we had proof that these things really work, there would be no trouble. But again, when something works, that's not good enough. When something works, we also have to make sure that it works and yet it doesn't cause a problem.
Dr. Dewa, one of Cameroon's leading traditional medicine promoters, says his field faces serious challenges because Cameroon has not enacted laws for the sector.
We need a law which will regulate traditional medicine. You cannot find somebody 40 where there's no law. You cannot tell somebody that you don't have the right when there's no law guiding. That is why there is this disorder. In fact, we will still continue to be singing like this until when the lawmakers one day will come up with a law that will guide our profession.
Dr. Mashidiso Moiti, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa, released a letter this week urging governments to strengthen regulatory bodies for traditional health practitioners. He also called upon researchers to work with traditional practitioners to produce scientific evidence on the safety, effectiveness, and quality of their products.
That was reporter Moki Edwin Kizeka reporting from Yaoundé, Cameroon. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with Commonwealth Games news. South Africa will host the 2022 British Commonwealth Games in Durban. The Commonwealth Games Federation disclosed in Auckland, New Zealand on Wednesday. South Africa Sports Confederation and Olympic Committee President SASCOC President Gideon Sam assures that the country is determined to stage the best Commonwealth Games ever, being the first time the quadrennial event will be staged on African soil. Meanwhile, hosts Italy outwitted Tunisia 11-1 as Libya prevailed over Greece 3-1 in beach soccer at the Mediterranean Beach Games in Pescara on Wednesday. Lebanon outplayed Algeria 10-4. Morocco dismissed Malta 7-2 and Egypt edged Turkey 3-2. Today, Thursday, Egypt tackled Malta. Tunisia faced Lebanon. Libya engaged France. Morocco faced Turkey as Algeria challenged Italy. Staying in Pescara, Egypt's Mohamed El Mozayem clocked 1 minute and 41.31 seconds to clinch a silver medal in men's 200 meters fin swimming. Algerian Mohamed Ben Yahya Nedja bagged the bronze medal, while Tunisia's women's 4x50 meters bifin swimming relay clinched a bronze medal. Algeria lie fourth on the medal table with 1 gold, 4 silver, and 4 bronze medals as of Wednesday. Egypt are fifth and Tunisia sixth. Turning to athletics, newly crowned world champions Ethiopians Genzebe Dibaba, Almaz Ayana, and Kenyan Vivian Cheruiyot clash in women's 3,000 meters at the IWF Diamond League in Zurich, Switzerland today, Thursday. Nigerian Blessing Okagbare Ighoteguenor, Kenyan Eunice Sum, South Africans Wenda Nell and Sunet Fulyun compete in women's 100 meters, 800 meters, 400 meter hurdles and javelin respectively. South African world champion Wade van Niekerk and Botswana's Isaac Makwala go head-to-head in men's 400 meters. Kenyan David Rudisha faces Algerian Taufik Makloufi in 800 meters as Kenyan Asbel Kiprop and Morocco's Abdelati Igida run the 1500 meters. The world's top four 3000 meter steeplechase runners, all from Kenya, Jairus Birech, Ezekiel Kemboi, Brimin Kiprop Kipruto, and Conseslus Kipruto face off. South Africa's Anaso Jobodwana, Godfrey Kotso Mokwena, and Nigerian Miles Ukaoma contest men's 200 meters long jump and 400 meter hurdles respectively. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Botti in Washington.
Daybreak and Africa awakens in the cities, in the villages. Africa awakens to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America with even more news about Africa. You're wide awake now. The Voice of America energizes your mornings with African beat, music from all over Africa. The evening meal is over now, but you can feast on the latest news on VOA's Africa News tonight. Time for bed. Let VOA serenade you with the world's best music. Tune us in around the clock on 6080 and 15580 kilohertz on the Voice of America.